So in the middle of explaining the Gaussian function, right? So every Gaussian function, 1D Gaussian function, can be won by a linear transformation from the standard Gaussian function where mu is equal to zero and sigma is equal to one, right? And this is, well, standard probability theory, the prototypical probability density function, right? And it has a lot of interesting properties. So, for example, on the set of real numbers, this is the probability distribution with the least amount of assumptions that you can make, right? So it's something that is in a certain sense a very general distribution. So if you have a discrete probability distribution where you would say you're having only, let's say, five discrete events, and you're having such a distribution, right? This is called a discrete probability function, if you want. And in such a discrete case, the distribution with the least amount of assumption is the distribution where everything is equally distributed, right? So the probability would here be exactly 1/5 for all of them, right? But you could be tempted to say that in the real case, something like this could be the most general or the one with the least assumptions. But that's surprisingly not true, because by drawing something like this, you would make very strong assumptions about these regions, right? Because you're having a non-continuous step here, right? And this actually contains a lot of information. So if you ever computed a Fourier transform of such a rectangular impulse, you would see that there's a lot of higher order harmonics, if you're into acoustics, that would be necessary to build such a thing, right? And by means of the Gaussian falling off smoothly to infinity, you're actually making the least assumptions, right? So this is like a very general type of probability distribution that we'll encounter in a lot of natural processes, right? And if we generalize the same idea to, let's say, two dimensions, right now here we're having x, and on the y-axis we're having p of x, right? P of x and x. And now we're having x1 and x2, and the probability function is such a head, hat coming out of the board, right? And these are the lines of where the function takes the same value, the iso lines, right? And as we see, for the two-dimensional Gaussian, these lines form ellipses in the general case, right? And the formula is rather simple. So we have P of x. If you would like to write it with a vector symbol, we can also write it as P of x, meaning the vector, which is P of x1, x2. And this is nothing but 1 over, and here we're having something strange, sigma to the minus 1, and here we'd have 1 over 2 pi, if I'm not completely mistaken. And then there is the x of minus 1/2 again. And now we're having x as the vector minus mu, right? So this is a two-component vector. This is also a two-component vector transpose. And here we're having this ominous thing, which I'll explain in a second. And again, this is another vector, right? So vector times, and this will turn out to be a matrix, times vector, right? Which gives a real number, which can be used as the argument of the exponential function. Now, what is this ominous matrix here that we want, right? So sigma is the so-called covariance matrix, right? Sigma is the covariance matrix, yeah? And this is a in our case where we're in R2, this is a 2x2 matrix, right, with certain entries, right? And on the these entries specify how these ellipses here are stretched in each direction and how this is rotated, right? So, and if you count the degrees of freedom, how many degrees of freedom do you have? So you can stretch in this direction, right? And you can measure the stretch in this direction. So this would be the two-dimensional analog of this standard deviation. How wide is the distribution in each direction, right? And you can rotate the whole thing about its center with an angle. That's the third degree of freedom, right? And now you might say, well, but there are four matrix entries, yeah? And the answer is this is a symmetric matrix. Yeah. So the this element and this element are always the same. Yeah. So it's a symmetric 2x2 matrix specifying how the Gaussian looks like, this hat function. Okay. And this is important. So in the end, what we're trying to do is we're trying to model our data distribution that we have. So we have a number of points. And our goal is still to cluster them, right? And in essence, how we do this is we say we want to model them with a single probability density function. And there are three quantities for each of the Gaussians that we insert here that we need to model. And that's the mean. So if we're having three Gaussians as here, this is the mean of the first, this is the mean of the second, and this is the mean of the third. And we have to model the geometric shape and rotation for each of the Gaussians, right? This is determined by the covariance matrix. And we're also having, there's the need to model the relative height of the Gaussians, right? For example, if you're having a lot of points here and very few points here, it would be natural to say here we should have a Gaussian that's very high, has a very large weight, while the Gaussian that models these points should be comparatively damped, right? And this can be guided by these linear factors here, okay? So there are three kinds of parameters that we need to model. And what does modeling mean? So in case of k-means, it meant to choose the cluster centers and then the matrix RNK that was responsible for the association of patterns to clusters, right? And this, we said, we modeled in an alternating fashion, which we will do here as well. So the only difference is that while fuzzy c-means and k-means favor spherical clusters, here we can also have elongated clusters in other forms, right? So this is a more flexible model and one which is also widely used, right? So one remark which might be confusing for persons that did not have yet anything to do with machine learning, but for those that had, just a remark. So usually what we have here is we say we have this distribution and we model them as a probability density function. And later on, if we want to know what cluster does this point belong to, we can compute the so-called responsibility. So that's the posterior probability of this point having been generated by this Gaussian, the red or the green or the blue, right? We'll see this, don't worry, right? But in most cases, if you want to classify, you have a Gaussian mixture model for each class, right? So if you're having a joint probability distribution where we denote the number of parameters of the model as theta, as always, and y is the random variable that denotes the class of a pattern, and x denotes the pattern itself. We know that we can write this as p of x given y and theta times p of y given theta. Right? And these things in classification, we usually call class conditional densities, and these we call class priors, right? And you're very free. So this is a perfectly general, generative classifier system, and you can insert any stochastic model you like. But usually for voice detection or so, what we take for this is itself a Gaussian mixture model. Right? So what you have there, for example, if you want to distinguish my voice against any other voices. So this is a two-class classification problem, meaning that y can basically take two values, let's say 0 and 1, okay? And my voice is then modeled by one Gaussian mixture model, right? Let's say there it would be modeled by two features only, which is not the case. And we're having here, this is like the sum of 10 Gaussians, right? Which is a surface here on that plane. And that's my voice. And this is then P of X for Y equal to 1, given my learned parameters. Okay. And then you'll be having another Gaussian mixture model, which looks a bit different. Yeah. And this is then the model P of X given Y equal to 2 or 0, whatever you want, right? Let's call it 0, okay? And in that fashion, you can also use Gaussian mixture models as class conditional density models in machine learning, but this is not what we want. Just a remark for those that are more into machine learning, right? So the only thing that is left to do is we're up to modeling the pi's, the mu's, and the sigmas. And again, as in k-means, you'd have to agree on your number of Gaussians before you model something. Yes? But in contrast to k-means, if you choose that number in the wrong way, what will happen is, so, or depends on the numerics, right? But what is likely to happen is that the surplus Gaussians become very flat and very, very low in height, right? So their weights will become low. And the ones that dominantly model your real clusters would then be very significant. So that's another flexible aspect of this. However, it's, as with all clustering approaches, the art form is choosing K correctly, right? So you have to have a guess in some sense, right? Now, once again, if we write theta in the conditional part of the probability, then we mean all the parameters. So theta is just another name for the pi's, the mu's, and the sigmas, and we need large k of them, right? Whereas each of them has a number of real values. So you see it's a very parameter-rich model, yes? So these are numbers, these are n-dimensional vectors, and this is an n by n symmetric matrix. And we'd have to have large K of those triples, right? So a lot of parameters that we need to address, right? Now, as always in machine learning, when you want to learn something with probabilistic methods, what this means is that either such a model or such a simple model like this, right? Whatever you do, at least in simple machine learning, is you're trying to fit your data to such a model. And that fitting means you have to determine your parameters in such a way that your data is most likely explained by your learned model, right? So the goal will be to learn those theta. And what we always assume is that this Gaussian mixture model, in our case here, sorry, should write it like this. This Gaussian mixture model is just the probability for one pattern, right? Now, as I said, if let's say we're having these two Gaussians here, and we're asking us what is the probability of generating this point, yeah, or what's the probability density for this point, I should say, then you'd have to take this whole surface and compute its functional value at that point, right? And so if we're having a large data set, meaning large n such measurements or data points, then the probability for the whole set is assumed to be the product of the probabilities of each data point. And that is the same as saying that each of those points has been drawn from the same probability distribution, from the same Gaussian mixture model. That means they're identically distributed. That's the first I. And the second thing is they're independently sampled, meaning that if one pattern was determined, it has nothing to do with the other pattern that was also determined, at least not from the point of view of a generation process, right? So they're independently, identically distributed, IID. And that means the probability of the whole set is the product of the probabilities of each of those patterns, right? And as I said, these patterns can be just simple points, as in this case, or points plus their class labels, as in classification. Right? Or points and their functional values, as in regression. Right? So this is, no matter what you train, it's always the same thing. Yeah? So, and this here, this thing here, which is given by this product, is called the likelihood for the parameters, if you want. Okay? So that means how likely does a given Gaussian mixture model explain the data that you have. The data is fixed and you have to choose between different models, right? Such, in that way, it is the likelihood for theta, and each theta determines an instance of the model, so it's a likelihood for theta. And this, the most simple form of machine learning is maximum likelihood learning. So what you want to determine is theta as the maximum argument that maximizes this likelihood. In other words, the gradient with respect to that has to vanish. And as we said last time, it's convenient to use the logarithm of this quantity, of this likelihood, because then the product will turn into a sum under the action of the logarithm. And that's very nice because it's much easier to compute the derivatives. So the derivatives of a product are always lengthy combinatorial expressions, whereas the derivative of a sum is always the sum of derivatives, right? This is nice. Now, let's start with a very simple example, okay? Let's assume we don't want to use a Gaussian mixture model. The only thing that we would like to do is we would like to learn a single Gaussian. So that's a Gaussian mixture model with only one cluster, in essence, right? So that means if you're having this and the data is somehow distributed like this, although you would like to model it with two Gaussians, let's assume we only want to learn a one Gaussian model. So we would have to place our Gaussian in a way that best covers the points, I should say, right? Rotate it, squeeze it, elongate it until it fits the data best. That's what you do. Now, now the probability distribution is not a mixture of Gaussians with these linear combinatorial factors, but it's just a single Gaussian, okay, which is given by that formula. Now, the log likelihood of this thing here, if you take the logarithm, is just here. These stem from the normalization factors. And in essence, it's just a quadratic form that's left, right? Because that's the argument of the exponential function, which is canceled by the natural logarithm, right? And now, if you want to do maximum likelihood, what does that mean? Well, we have to compute the derivatives with respect to our quantities. So in order to find the mu for our Gaussian, what would we have to do? We'd have to compute the gradient of the log likelihood with respect to mu. Bam. And if you do so, it's very simple. You can look this up in, for example, the matrix cookbook. For those that are not really fit with matrix calculus, there's large amounts of formula collections where you can look up what's the result of computing the gradient of this quadratic form. And let your intuition guide you. So you know perfectly from school that d to the dx of x squared is 2x, right? So if you compute the derivative of something quadratic, then something linear should come out, right? And this is what turns out to be the result. And for most of you, this should be really reasonable. Because if I want to model a cloud of points with a Gaussian that has a center, what's the best choice for this center? The answer is it's the barycenter of all the points. Bam. Yeah. The average. And that's exactly what's written here, right? So you add together, here there's a small n equal to 1 missing, you add together all the pattern vectors and divide by their number. Bam. And so you find the center of the Gaussian. And if you think of what should the matrix look like that governs the rotation and the elongation, well, in essence, you might know the formula for the empirical variance that is very simple and straightforward. And this is just its multidimensional generalization. So x minus the center times x minus the center transpose. Okay? And this is not the normal scalar product, right? The scalar product of two vectors would be A transpose B. What we have here is AB transpose. So this is a single number and this would be a matrix, right? And so you can write this down and you'll see, well, this is just the empirical covariance matrix that you would expect. Yeah. So, and on the diagonal, there is the, so where do I have it? Okay. Here's the covariance matrix. Okay. So if you would rotate it back, what you would get here is just the variance in the x direction. This is the variance, or the x1 direction. This is the variance in the x2 direction. And this is the correlation coefficient. Yes? So let's assume your points are distributed like that, right? X1 and x2, right? So what we see is that if we get larger with x1, x2 also gets larger, right? So because they seem to be laid out along this dividing line here, okay? So this means that both measurements are perfectly or more or less perfectly linearly correlated, right? And this correlation coefficient, you know that the matrix is symmetric, so there are no two correlation coefficients. It's just the one is the same as the other. So this measures the amount of linear correlation in the data. Yeah? And the respective Gaussian would potentially look like this. Yeah? So this shows you that the correlation is quite good, right? And this we will see later on. Okay, so for the single Gaussian, the results are completely intuitive, yeah? So as you would expect from simple statistics. Now, what would be the result for a Gaussian mixture model? Now, the only difference is that now we're having k of these Gaussian functions and their linear factors. Okay, but we can pull through the same stuff. Before we do that, one word with respect to representational issues, right? So, in essence, what we assume is that the data has been generated, for example, by this three Gaussian model, okay? So these three Gaussians are equipped with linear factors and then added together, which gives us a surface, right? And this is the probability density function. Now, but the story could be a bit different, right? So you could say that each data point in your data set has been generated by one of the Gaussians only, yes? Either by the red or by the blue or by the green, or whatever number you have, right? And this is something that we assume to be the case, but obviously in the end, we just cannot really measure this, right? That's just a made-up story. And the variables that are associated with this made-up story are called latent variables, right? Latent because you just cannot measure them. And this variable Z just denotes this latent nature of each data point. So for each data point xn, we're having a corresponding variable zn, at least we assume that to be the case, which tells us by which Gaussian has this point been generated. Okay? And these zn can be conveniently represented. And what we will see is that these pi k are associated with the prior probabilities for these Zn, right? So how are they represented? So Zk is either 0 or 1. And for if we sum over all k, the sum must be 1, right? So for each of these large k many Gaussians, we're having one component in Z, right? So for this case here, for this case, where we have three Gaussians, our Z17, meaning the Z for the 17th pattern, would be a three-dimensional vector, and with zeros in all places except for one, right? And that means that pattern number 17 has been generated by the second Gaussian. And if it were like 1, 0, 0, it would have been created by the first Gaussian, okay? So, and this is exactly what these things mean, right? If we sum over all components, here the sum must be 1, right? And the probability for each position to be 1 is this prior probability pi k. Right? So, if we, let's say we're having again a number of data points here, here several and here several, right? And we model this with a two Gaussian mixture model, right? Let's say in here we're having 70 points and in here we're having 30 points, right? Then we're having a prior probability of 0.3 and 0.7 in this case, right? So that's an interpretation for those pi k and nothing else. Now, if we are interested in the conditional probabilities, so what is the probability of producing a pattern x if we assume that it has been generated by the kth Gaussian? Well, this is the kth Gaussian, simply put. Right? Because let's assume we're looking at this pattern point here where the cursor is, right? And we assume that it has been generated by the green Gaussian. What is the probability? Well, we have to see how the Gaussian falls off and determine its value at this precise point, right? And this is nothing else but what is said here, right? So the probability of X under the condition that ZK is 1 is given by that Gaussian. And if we write it in that fashion, we're using something that's called the 1 of K representation, because we know that only one of the components can be 1, right? So we can write it as the Gaussian to the power ZK, because what only survives of this expression is that Gaussian which actually generated the point, right? So P of X, notwithstanding the Gaussians, we would have to sum over all the Z of the joint probability distribution and this is again our Gaussian mixture model, right? So this is a technique that you would always find when you use latent quantities in machine learning. Yeah, so latent variables are some made-up story that you assume to be the case, yeah, but that you just cannot measure, because in the end you can only measure the actual data points. And so you cannot make, so you don't have any full knowledge which Gaussian created which point. That is something that you just don't know. So what you do is you have to sum out these variables. You have to compute the sum over it, over the joint probability distribution. And summing out is one of the standard techniques in probability theory. Conditioning with Bayes' rule and summing out. And if you have those, you can practically do anything. One remark again, if you're not really sure about probability theory, take Bishop's book and read, I think it's the first or the second chapter. Not very many pages, very concise introduction to probability, all you need, and that's that, right? Now, this is what we want to learn. Now, good. One more thing, right? So here we have the probability density of X, assuming that it has been generated by the kth Gaussian, which is the kth Gaussian, okay? Now, what if we ask for what is the probability of the kth Gaussian being responsible if we have a certain pattern X, right? So in essence, what this means is that we're having this model and we're having such a point here where the cursor is, okay? Now we can ask ourselves, what's more likely, that the blue Gaussian was responsible for that point, or the green or the red, right? In this case, it's a bit ambivalent, right? So you don't know. If I take this point here, it's very clear that the likelihood that the blue Gaussian was responsible is much larger than the green or even the red one, because the red one has already fallen off very severely at that point. The green one has also fallen off, but the blue one is still mighty and large, right? So we can ask ourselves, what is the probability or the responsibility, if you're having this point, what's the responsibility of each Gaussian? And that's precisely that formula, right? And this is called gamma of ZK. These are called the responsibilities, okay? Now, how can you arrive at that? And the answer is just with the help of Bayes' theorem, okay? Now, for those, the gamers might not have that readily available because they didn't have discrete probability. Now, the stuff is very simple, right? If I have two random variables, let's call them A and B, the probability of A given B is the probability of B given A times P of A divided by P of B, right? And P of B can naturally be written as sum over all A's, right? Where we would have P of A and B, which is nothing but the sum over all A's of P of B given A equal to A times P of A equal to A, right? And this is exactly what is written here, right? So in order to reverse the probabilities, right, you would have to just apply Bayes' rule. And we know all the quantities. So these are our priors, pi k. These quantities here are our respective single Gaussians. And in the denominator, you're having precisely this equation here, sum over A, P of B, given A times P of A. Right? This is exactly what happens. Now, let's visualize this a bit more clearly, right? So the leftmost picture, we see a lot of data points, right? And each data point has a distinct, pure color. So it's either fully red, fully blue, or fully green. this corresponds to our full knowledge. So this corresponds to knowing which Gaussian is responsible for which point exactly. So this is a knowledge that we don't have. What we actually see is the middle picture, the pink picture, right? So we see a lot of points, but we don't know which Gaussian created them, because the Gaussians are just a fiction of us, right? It's just a model we chose to fit to the data. The data is the only thing that has some reality. The model is just our invention, right? And what we do is we can compute, if we, let's assume we laid out the Gaussians already quite nicely, we can then evaluate this formula here for each point here, for this, and also those points, right? And what we see is that those points that are really in close vicinity to the red Gaussian, there the responsibility, gamma of the red Gaussian, is also very large, whereas the responsibility for the green and the blue one is almost zero. That's why these points appear almost totally red. And here in between, where you don't know whether the green or the red Gaussian was the one responsible, we'd have a mixture where the green and the red color elements are as large or equally large. Same here, right? So this is what we will want to have for our model, because that will give us the responsibilities or the degree of belonging to a cluster. So this is in an analog to the fuzzy C means membership matrix, if you want, right? And this is why we're doing all of this. Now, maximum likelihood, simple. We're having this. This is our Gaussian mixture model. We're taking the logarithm, and this gives us this formula, right? Which is okay, right? So the product of the IID distribution turns into a sum, right? But we would still have to sum. Sorry, this is the product over all the IID data points. However, what we have is something that is not so nice, and that is, the sum over all the Gaussians, over all the clusters, is inside the logarithm. That is something we usually don't want, because there is no functional equation telling you how to dissolve or resolve the logarithm of a sum. You know that the logarithm of a product is the sum of the logarithms, but ln A plus B, there is no such formula. Okay, and that will turn out to be quite ugly. Good. Why is that ugly? So we can pull through the same program as before, right? So here we pull through the same program for a single Gaussian, maximum likelihood, and it turned out to deliver us what we expect. Now, if you do the same program, compute the log likelihood and compute the gradient with respect to all of your parameters, what you get is these formula, right? Let's look at them in turn. First, what is the center of each Gaussian? It suspiciously looks like the center of gravity of all the points, nk points, that have been generated by this Gaussian times the patterns, yeah, or the sum of all these patterns, right? Times this prefect. So the average of all the points in the cluster multiplied with the responsibilities, okay? And that should remind us of the analog expression in fuzzy C means, right? Because there we also had the responsibility times the pattern divided by the number of patterns in these respective, in this respective cluster, right? So this kind of makes sense. It's a generalization of this intuitive result for the single Gaussian. And the same is true for the covariance matrix. It also looks like the covariance for the single Gaussian. The only difference is, again, we have to multiply it by the responsibility factors, okay? And the prior probabilities are also totally intuitive. So as I said here, if there are 70 points being generated by this cluster and 30 by that, the prior probability for this cluster is 0.3, and for this cluster it's 0.7. Bam. Yeah. So this is what this is. And the number of patterns in that cluster K is the sum over all the responsibility values, right? If the responsibility values were binary, so if gamma was not a probability, but either 0 or 1, this makes totally sense. Now it's in 0 and 1, so the fuzzy case. And now nk is not an even number, right? It can also be 2.3. So that means 2.3 points are expected to lie in cluster number 5, right? Good. So this is very fine. We have found the solution. Thank you. Goodbye. No, we have not. And that's, there's a problem, right? If we go back, what we see is that in order to compute these responsibilities, we already need these quantities. So we need the pi's, the mu's, and the sigmas in order to compute the responsibilities, right? But in order to compute the mu's, the pi's, and the sigmas, we need the responsibilities. But where do we start? And that's a problem, right? So you need the apples to compute the pears, and you need the pears to compute the apples, right? And that's a problem. Where do you start? And if you remember what we did in fuzzy c-means or k-means, the answer is just to alternate, right? So what you do is you assume some random starting variable for the mu's, the pi's, and the sigmas. You then compute the responsibilities, and then you compute the new versions of the mu's, the pi's, and the sigmas, which in turn you use to compute new responsibilities, which you then in turn use to compute new pi's, mu's, and sigmas. Always bang, 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 just as in k-means. In k-means, you use the membership matrix evaluation to compute new cluster centers. The new cluster centers you could use to compute the membership degrees with the nearest neighbor rule, and so on, right? This is just the same, and the algorithm is called expectation maximization, okay? So this is just the way you use, okay? So in step T, you evaluate the responsibilities using the parameters of the previous step, and then you evaluate the parameters of step number T using the responsibilities that you computed. That's basically it, okay? Good. And if we look at how this happens, so let's assume we're having these green points. Once again, we don't know which Gaussian is responsible. And we start with a simple guess, two spherical normal Gaussians, right? So just you start with this matrix sigma equal to the identity matrix and mu somewhere in that space, right? And then what you compute is the responsibilities. So what is the probability that this point has been generated by the blue Gaussian? And what is the probability that this point has been generated by the red Gaussian? Okay. Since it's nearer to the blue one, it should have a bluish hue, slightly purple, right? But this one here, which is much closer to the red one, should be much more red than blue. Okay. And these are the responsibilities. Having the responsibilities, we can compute the new form of the new Gaussians, right? And so we see that these are predominantly blue and these are predominantly red. So we get two elongated clusters, Gaussians close by, right? And then we compute the new responsibilities, giving rise to new estimation of the Gaussians, and so on and so on. And at the end, we arrive at this intuitive solution where each Gaussian lays atop of a coherent cloud of points, right? And this Gaussian mixture model is a formulation as a target function, which also formalizes the clustering paradigm. Intra-cluster coherence and inter-cluster decoherence. Bam, that's that. Okay. And this is just the algorithm one more time in words just for your reference, right? Now, one general view before we get to a new topic, right? So, as I said, very characteristically, if you're having latent variables in machine learning, you very often face that problem. And the problem numerically is that the summation is inside the logarithm, or in other words, you have to know the latent quantities in order to compute your model parameters, but the model parameters again depend on the latent quantities. And this is like this mutual dependence that you will always have, right? Or at least if the model is expressive, to express something, right? So our model P of the data set given the parameters or its logarithm, here you would have to sum over the latent quantities, and this summation is inside the logarithm, right? So summing out variables expresses that you just don't know the Z. So you have to sum over them, right? This is what you do, right? So if we would know the complete data set, so if we would know for each pattern X the Gaussian that generated it, then we could do everything, right? Because P of X given Z is actually a very simple exponential form probability density function, so we could easily solve for that. But the problem is we don't know that. What we know is the probability that a certain Gaussian was responsible given the pattern in question. So these are our responsibilities. So what we then do is we compute the expectation of the quantity that we know, or we should put it in other words, we should compute the expectation of the quantity that interests us with respect to the probability distribution that we know. And this is called Q. This is what we evaluate in the E step. And in the M step, we compute the new form of the parameters, right? And for those that would like to have it in general, it's explained on these slides, but I won't go through all the math because I'm seeing a little bit of tired faces, right? So it's a good homework to think that through. This is the last slide of this, right? Because you can ask yourself, well, if k-means and its alternating optimization are, well, it seems a bit related to the Gaussian mixture model stuff. Is there a deeper relation? And the answer is yes, of course. K-means is just a special case of Gaussian mixture model learning, right? Because if we use large K, and this should be a large K, not a small K, if we use large K Gaussians with a covariance matrix that is just diagonal, so for two dimensions it would be the diagonal matrix, the Gaussians itself will take this very simple form. And for the responsibilities, we would get this also slightly simplified expression. Now, you would start, this is called an isotropic Gaussian. So a hat function that has, well, a standard deviation in x and y direction of 1, right? So well-behaved hat. Now, if you say that the width of this hat should be modeled by an epsilon, meaning that you have the degree of freedom to make this ever steeper, right? To shrink it down in the x and y dimensions, and then it must become ever higher because the integral must be 1, right? To make it more extreme, so to speak, right? What happens in the limit epsilon going towards 0? If you compute a Taylor expansion of these responsibilities, right, or more exactly a Taylor expansion of the expectation of Z given this logarithmic likelihood here, what you get is this function, okay? And as we saw, or if you see it, if you work through the math, this is the quantity that we exactly use in the expectation maximization. These are very closely relinked to the responsibilities, right? And as we see, the only term that survives is that quadratic term, which is the objective function of k-means, bam, right? And all you do in k-means is to maximize this objective function, because this is a formulation of intra-cluster coherence, right? So that the distance of the xn from the cluster centers mu k should be as small as possible, right? And you compute the extremal value of this. So what we see here is, if we use isotropic Gaussians, meaning round Gaussians, or in other words, spherical clusters, and if we let the fuzziness of the cluster, which corresponds to the width of the Gaussian, go to zero, if we ever shrink this more to a point, what we get is k-means, right? And this is what the connection actually is. Okay, cool. So let's leave it at that. So one word for wrap up, and one word in terms of how to learn this, right? So as you know, there is, at the end of the slide set, there is tips for all three sorts of students, right? So what is to be done for the minimal learner, right? The one that says, go home with your Gaussian mixture models. That's also nice, but I can't stand the math. Please die. Yeah. So what should be done by persons like that? So what I would advise those persons to do is to work their way through the basic ideas of the slide set and leave out the Gaussian mixture models, for God's sake, right? And so the normal learner, which, and I have to emphasize that this machine learning stuff is really crucial for social computing, right? So if you look through the papers on the conferences, they're all full of machine learning. And machine learning is super simple. So in most cases, the only thing that you do is you choose some sort of model, may it have latent variables or not, right? And you model the parameters via maximum likelihood. If it's very sophisticated, you use maximum posterior. And if you're super sophisticated, you use a Bayesian method, but that's over the top. Nobody in standard social computing would do that. So because it's so popular, so nice, and so ever-present, I would advocate that you at least try to understand Gaussian mixture models as a prominent example, right? And then there's two possibilities. Either you want to learn something about probability, my tip would be read that in Bishop's book, and I will put online the respective pages today, right? I already put online the respective pages explaining the Gaussian mixture models, right? These are already online. I will also put online those for basic probability theory, right? And for the advanced people that would really like to go deeper into this, I would say try to work yourself through this general view of the expectation maximization as well, right? If you should have any questions, come to me and we'll discuss everything, right? I think that's a good approach, right? So all of you should be happy, and it should be manageable for each sort, okay? Cool. Good. So let's stop it here and get to a new topic, right? And I think this may be a bit more accessible for some of you. Now, what's this new topic about? So the new topic is about real-world networks, right? So we're back in the realm of graphs. Why that? I mean, shouldn't it be better off located before the actual data mining lecture? Well, the answer is now we're going to do both, right? So in the network analysis part, what we did was to actually analyze, for example, the centrality of a single node, okay, or analyze, is this subgraph a cluster or an n-plex or something? Sorry, yeah? But now what we want to do is we want to look at real-world networks in terms of very large networks, right? But there's a severe paradigm shift in the whole science of networks, because in the 1980s or even in the early 1990s, people that would do social network analysis would really strictly analyze graphs of sizes, let's say 100, right? So large families or mafia networks or company networks within small KMUs and stuff. But what we're facing today is we're facing a paradigm shift to networks of a billion nodes. Yeah. So the Facebook social graph has a billion nodes, right? Or the network of linked pages of the web has like 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 nodes, right? And what we need to do is we cannot analyze each individual centrality or stuff, right? This is nice, and Google does that with PageRank, right? Obviously on a large scale. But in this lecture, we're much more interested in descriptive properties of these networks. So statistical descriptors that tell us something about the general nature of the networks, right? So path lengths, clustering coefficients, mixing patterns, degree distributions, and stuff like that, right? So this is a severe paradigm shift, and it has brought a boost in network analysis. Now, this lecture has a background reading, as all the lectures have, and this is another paper by Mark Newman, right? I already linked this on Piazza. It's a survey paper on networks. It's already quite old, right? It is from 2003, and Mark Newman has authored a book called Networks that's more or less the book version of this survey article. However, the book version has 400 pages and the survey article, I don't know, like 30 or something, right? So it's a much more convenient background reading for us. And most of the basic results, I think, are still valid. Okay. So for those that want to dig deeper into this, you're referred to the book, but I would not seem it very likely. Right. If you read the survey paper, you have already done a lot, because it's really a very good survey paper, a well understandable, well written survey paper. Right. Now, why are we interested in these descriptive factors? Well, a visualization is almost impossible. Right. If you look at visualizations of large networks, you don't see very much. Right, it's just a war of edges, right? And if we have time at the end, we might look at strategies for visualizing networks. However, we don't see much, so it's a bit pointless. And thus, we're interested in these other quantities. And the realms of those networks are really vast, right? So you can have technological networks, right? So what's the network of that? Is on a chip inside of your computer, or what's the wireless tower network, the cellular network that you do your phone calls over, right? You'd have social networks, you have informational networks such as the web, and you also have biological networks. Good. We see that social networks, in our case, can be formalizations of social context. And what's really nice is, as with all these things, that if you look at these real-world data, what you have is the human in its natural habitat, right? So you don't have any laboratory effects that would come through questionnaires and other indirect means of estimating what people are like, right? So you can just say, well, that's obviously the friendship graph on Facebook. And well, now you can do social network analysis. Or as a PhD student from KIT that I know, she has recently written a paper that I had to review. And for example, her assessment was, if people have a personality structure, how different is their posting behavior on Facebook compared to their true personality structure? Would people make up their lives? Yeah. So like photographing, oh, my food or my car and my life and watch me kite surfing. And how large is that difference, right? Because that is interesting if you say, this is the natural habitat human. Well, it's the natural habitat human on Facebook, which doesn't say 100% something about how the true social networking structure is, right? So that is also to be taken cum grano salis. Now, let's look at some examples. So information networks, right? So obviously the most studied example is the web, right? And what can we say about the web? One example is that the probability distribution of degrees is a so-called power law on the web, right? So that means that the probability of a node, meaning a web page, has links to k pages is k to the minus alpha. And that's something that is so typical for a lot of networks, right? So this is something that occurs in other examples as well. One example is, for example, a citation network, right? So what is the probability that a given scientific paper cites k other papers, right? And as we will see, this has to fall off to infinity because the probability that a paper cites 2 trillion papers is zero. And the probability that it cites one other paper is also zero because due to the peer review process, such a paper would never get accepted, right? So somehow for zero, it's small, and for infinity, it's also small. So it must have some sort of bump size around some quantity, right? And that's what a power law actually models quite well, right? At least for the larger fall off, right? Good. What are other examples? Right. For example, preference networks. So for those that are in Wolfgang's lecture that starts at 2, Wolfgang talks about recommender systems, systems that recommend you items. And if you model this as a network problem, you're having a bipartite network, one of users, the other one of items, and edges in between if, for example, the user saw a certain movie, right? And recommender systems boil down to predicting links in these networks, right? There's the large body of movies that are out there. There's you, your Lonesome Rider. And the question is, what of these movies, which of these would you like with a high probability? That's what a recommender system does, right? For example, with collaborative filtering. Other examples are the mentioned ontologies that we talked about. So these would give rise to semantic networks, right? So what is the probability that the concept ape is linked to human compared to the probability that ape is linked to projector? This is something you can ask yourself. Word networks, right? If you take a text and don't convert it to a TF-IDF vector, but instead you say, I lay out all the words of the text, and then I draw a link if, for example, they occur within a distance of, I don't know, at least 5, right? And this gives a network, and this has properties and carries at least aspects of the semantics of the network, right? And what we talked about, social media, explicitification of relations, right? This is a tripartite network, author, item, and tag. And such a tripartite network would be called a folksonomy, right? This is something we also discussed. Technological networks, the internet itself, right? So what is the network of routers and gateways and other computers, web servers, electric power grids, traffic networks, and so on. And you can already imagine, so most of you will have a driver's license, right? And most of you will have used that driver's license in Munich. And in German, that's a 6-, right? Because in Munich, every 2 meters, there's a traffic light, and it's guaranteed to be red, right? I don't know how any traffic can flow in the city. It's guaranteed 100% to be red. You drive, red. You wait 5 minutes. You drive, Yes, and it's red. 5 minutes. It's 10 minutes red. Okay, you drive. Ah, red. Shit. Such a coincidence. So, and that's people that model this, work on this with complicated model, and these are network models, right? Because obviously the people in the city's administration don't want to optimize the flow through the network. What they want to optimize is the frustration of the drivers to make them use public transport, right? And that's a network optimization problem. How can you maximize frustration? Yeah, that's a simple problem, right? And then power grids. So in German, Energiewende, right? This is a real problem. Since we're going away from centralized nuclear power plants for obvious reasons, and we're going towards more decentralized ecological energy production, well, you'd have to ensure that the voltages and the stuff still is in line and in the green field, right? So how do you do this? Network optimization, right? This is what you have. Biological networks, right? So each of you that has had something to do with biochemistry or has a friend that studies medicine or whatever, life science, all these people have these large posters in their labs, which are called biological pathways, and which tells you how citric acid is metabolized into whatever. Yeah, I don't know all this by heart. Gene and protein interaction networks and protein-protein interaction networks, right? So how the genes and the proteins are related is, well, 1990s life science. Today's life science is much more about how proteins interact among themselves, right? Which is an even more complicated temporal networking process than the gene-protein interactions, right? Food networks, ecological networks, so the hare is eaten by the fox and the fox is eaten by the wolf, and what is the population? If the foxes die out because of a disease X, what will happen to the wolves and the hares, right? Also a network problem. Now, these are visualizations of three networks, and so the first one is a predator-prey interaction network in a freshwater lake, and we see that we don't see much, right? So at least I cannot see anything. So I don't know what the predators are. I don't know what the prey is. So what we already see is that this is a bad social network visualization, right? And we can see that there are better methods to do this. I assume that it's somehow a force-based layout, but a not very well used, right? And, well, network number B, is the network of collaborations between scientists and a research institute. And obviously what I would suspect is that this is a so-called pathfinder network visualization. And the pathfinder network is not the graph itself, but the union of all the minimum spanning trees, right? So this is a much more convenient visualization, which leaves out unimportant edges. And what we can already see is that it falls apart into disjoint clusters. And these are working groups and other organizational frames. And number C is obviously a network of sexual contacts. And there are some people that are more active than others, right? They form hubs. Why would that be interesting? You already have guessed it, for epidemic reasons, right? So the early AIDS researchers, HIV guys, would have drawn such networks to find out, who's doing what with whom, and in order to project probabilities of spreading of diseases, right? And this is also possible for the flu and other serious infectious diseases. For example, here with these viral things, you might be more inclined to draw networks with respect to location, right? So who is close to whom in order to predict spreading of diseases on these networks, and we'll investigate the basic techniques for this as well, right? Good. Now, what we will do tomorrow is we'll dive into this world, and we will describe properties in terms of their we will describe networks in terms of their properties, and we will find out about interesting models for network growth, why the rich get richer all the time, what is a power law network, what is a small world, why do you know Osama bin Laden over four edges, is it hard, is it not hard, all these things tomorrow, right? So see you then.